Welcome to the CG Pro podcast. This is episode 57 with Brian Grill. And if you enjoy what you hear today, you can follow us at becomecgpro.com or in our Facebook group. So I'm very excited to have this conversation today. Brian has an amazing career stretching back to some really iconic moments in computer graphics history, going back to Titanic and those days where Digital Domain were figuring out how to do all of this stuff. Brian is now a visual effects supervisor at Scanline. Brian, it's a great pleasure to have you here with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You bet. Well, we've worked on so many cool movies, and I'd love to touch on at least 10% of them if we can. But some amazing projects. Really, some of the things that helped figure out what visual effects is and was Fifth Element, Day After Tomorrow, Titanic, some incredible formative visual effects movies. Another question I have is, at the beginning of your career, I know that you worked in Santa Monica. Did you work on Max Headroom?
I did, in Hollywood. I was in the, what we call the machine room at a post-production facility called the Post Group in Hollywood, which the place where it sat, now Netflix has a building right on there. So I'm currently, Scanline is owned by Netflix. So I always drive by that and go, I might be working at the same address that I worked my first job sometime. So I look forward to that in the future.
Very cool. I remember that from when I was a kid. I remember being inspired by that. That's really cool seeing that in your bio. So how did this begin for you? Did you always want to get into film visual effects? What were some early kind of things that happened to make this happen?
I think for me, I was one of those kids that found a Super 8 camera. My sister lived in St. Louis and I was living in California, and I would visit her during the summer. So I'd take a train, St. Louis, and I found this old 8mm, wasn't even Super 8, 8mm camera that my brother-in-law had. And, you know, there wasn't much for me to do. She was working. I was just kind of hanging out during the day, and I was able to get film and just kind of coming up with stuff. Eventually, I met a bunch of kids, and we had Super 8 film, and we would shoot ourselves riding bikes and, you know, doing the $6 million man, you know, reversing the film as we would jump off the fence or something like that, and blow up models. That was the big thing, you know, get firecrackers, build a model and light it on fire and blow it up. So I guess I've always had that interest. And then it really wasn't until I was 20, 21, where college wasn't really working out for me. And I was working steady, but I was like really, you know, thinking, what am I going to do? And it was an aha moment. I was watching Star Trek, the movie, you know, the original movie. And I saw some really cool effects, and I was like, how did they do that? Like, that was really cool. Found UCLA has night classes, and they have professionals in all different industries, but also the film industry. And at the time, MTV was, you know, just starting out. So I love music and I love film. So I took a course called Producing Music Videos and Post-Production in Film and Television. In the Producing Music Videos, every week they brought in somebody like a producer, a choreographer, a director, an editor. And when the editor came in, I was like, wow, that is the coolest thing, because you get to see all the pieces and then you get to kind of put it all together. And especially, you know, with music videos, you know, it's all sight and sound, and I was just blown away. And fortunately, that editor, Charlie Randazzo, if you look back and, you know, back in the day, the Post Group was the right up there with doing all the cutting edge music videos at the time. So anyway, there was a tour and of the Post Group in Hollywood, and I went on it. And you go into these edit bays at the time, and they were like rocket ships, you know, big boards with lights, and it was, and you know, very comfortable in there because the clients were, you know, need to be comfortable, and it was just really cool. And I just on the way out, I asked the guy at the film vault where you would bring your, you know, all your materials in for the edit session, go, how do I get a job? Gave me a number. And that summer, I literally called for 2 months, every once a week for 2 months, until finally I got an interview. And I went in there and was talking with the HR person, and she was showing me around and taking me all around, and she really liked me and I really wanted to work there. And then she looked at my resume, and the prerequisite for the library job was 4-year college education, and I did not have that. And she was like, ah. So she like looked in her Rolodex, and she's like, washed dishes in the, you know, they had a kitchen on site to feed the employees and the customers. And she's like, no, I can't do that to you. And then it was nighttime receptionist. And she's like, would you do that? And I'm like, hell yeah. And so, you know, for a year straight, it was, welcome to Post Group, can I help you? You know, and I would do it so much that even when I went home, I would answer the phone, Post Group, can I help you? And then from there, it just like, I just talked to everybody and just did whatever I could on my own time to learn what they were doing in the back room. Like, how do I get to sit in that chair in front of that switchboard of lights and make magic? And I was there for 6 years and kind of worked my way, you know. I stepped on a few toes because I wasn't really knew what I was doing. I would just show up and just start figuring stuff out. People are like, whoa, you can't be doing that. And I'm like, why not? Why can't I do it? But then I kind of learned the ropes, and from there, went to work for a company, which was kind of a spinoff of the Post Group, a lot of the key talent. And we were working on the Star Trek Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and I learned a lot doing that. And right then was the time when Optical was definitely moving into the digital world. And so we were doing these digital effects, and then we were like, how do we get this to film? So they would take these digital effects and then shoot them on to film and then use them, you know, as film effects. And I was, on a few of those early testing, and, it worked for certain things, you know, things that felt that were okay to feel a little low res. And then, you know, the Flame came out soon after that. And then the rest is history. I worked at Digital Domain, and one of the first projects I worked on was Apollo 13. And we had like 12 flames. And then when Titanic came along, there were 17 flames. Like, it was unbelievable. And you're working with all these really talented people. It was just a really, really great time in visual effects, because it was this kind of new world where we were going from optical to digital, and everything that came with that, including CGI and, you know, simulations and stuff that, you know, just blew my mind, because I was mostly a 2D type of person, where I would, you know, you can take it as far as you possibly can. You know, we were able to, you know, take photographs of dirt or some weird thing and map it onto a sphere, and you have a planet. You know, so anyway, that was the heyday.
Amazing. Yeah, it must have been a very exciting time. I have heard stories. I mean, my wife Jackie worked at DD for 10 or so years, and friends with some of the people. I'm sure you work with Les Ecker and Kevin Mack and those guys. Yeah, really, really cool. So initially I wanted to get into practical effects, and it was after that transition had happened, it made more sense to get into digital effects. And the movie that inspired me was Jurassic Park, and I just devoured all the making ofs, and like, that's what I got to do.
Yeah, I just saw a documentary called Jurassic Punk, which is you should definitely check it out. It's a really eye-opening experience of how digital world back then, how, you know, it started, and, you know, kind of leads you to the path of where we are today. So check it out.
I will, definitely. I haven't seen it yet, but it's on my list. I have less time these days with having kids and a business to run, but I definitely want to see that one. So what, you covered a lot of things there. I mean, there's the transition to digital must have been a really significant moment. Were you working on the Flame and then on the compositing side?
Yeah, I worked on the Flame, and at the time, Digital Domain was also working on their proprietary compositing software, Nuke. And so it was, first of all, that during that time, we had a model shop, just like ILM and a lot of the visual effects houses, the few that were around back then. And to me, that was the perfect marriage. You know, we were able to do practical stuff, and we were almost just embellishing on a lot of the physically based stuff. And, that to me is, even to this day, it's really about, working with all the departments and figuring out how to make the best visual to help tell the story. And it doesn't have to be one or the other. I think you learn so much, from working with people, and B, having, like, for existence, we were talking about earlier, having, these wonderful cameramen and women who, maybe, in a lot of the movies we do today, a lot of people call some of the stuff that is shot as reference, because, the director's like, that stunt didn't quite happen the way they want, or it didn't feel, felt like they might have been on wire. So they're like, how can we make this, feel better? But it's always the camera move. I think the camera and performances always kind of take the top spot on how good a visual effects shot will be. So I just love that it's really a team effort, and hopefully there could be more of that, instead of I find these days a lot of departments or producers in general just rely on visual effects to do, a lot of cleanup work, which is fine. It keeps a lot of people busy, and, and it's great. But, there's a little bit of, like, I don't want to say laziness, but, a little, it'd be great if we can kind of be more together in the thought process and look forward, executing something so it can stay in the movie and, not have to change it or change your mind, every 5 seconds until you end up with, version one.
Right. Yeah. it's interesting how decisions get made in that whole pipeline, and who makes them, whether they're being made creatively or out of kind of fear of something not being signed off or whatever. It's Seeing virtual production start to become more popular, and still finding itself, but for me, that's been an interesting experiment in that, I guess, bringing visual effects and film were very separate for most of my career, and seeing visual effects happen in a completely different location. People wouldn't really speak to each other. You just get a shot at the end of its life and have to service it. But virtual production, it feels like these two worlds are coming together more than ever.
Yeah, and I think the key to that is kind of knowing what your what the boundaries are, how to be, you know, use it in the most successful way. Because, you know, there's like anything, there's like a little bit of marketing that happens, like, oh, you know, this new thing. And, you know, you get in there and then you realize, you know, if you just didn't set it up or know what your parameters are, you know, then all of a sudden you end up, you know, maybe changing stuff more than you would like to, because the whole idea is to try to capture something and, you know, in camera, so to speak, and, you know, and then you're good. And virtual production just brings so much to the table. I mean, just lighting, you know, when you do a traditional green screen shoot, you know, your DP and you're lighting it to what you think would work with the background. And if you're lucky, you know what that background is. And a lot of movies that we work on now, you know, we have a still frame from a concept from the art department, and you kind of know, but, you know, it goes through so many changes. And then, you know, before it ends up on film. So I think, you know, virtual production and, you know, LED screens, for that example, allows you to help incorporate your performers or the action, you know, into the background. And I think that's, you know, super, super cool.
Being able to see it in real time with the people making the decisions. And
yeah,
it makes it more collaborative in that way. Like you said, you got to do it right, but...
No, it's when it works well. And when it doesn't, you can see it. But I think, you know, like anything, you know, we learn something every day and we, you know, hone in on, you know, past experience even. Like, doesn't always have to rely on the latest, greatest, fastest, better. Like, you can slow it down and think, okay, what would we have done, you know, 10 years ago? How can we take that experience and apply it? And and I think that's kind of the beauty of it, because it is filmmaking. It's not this, that, or the other. It's everybody like going, okay, we're in a different location. We got a few different, technical things we can work with, and just, you know, making the best product. And obviously at the end of the day, it's all about serving the story. It's not about, you know, how technical advanced it is. It's like, does it serve the story?
Should be that. Yeah. It should be about that. Sometimes people, I think, get caught up in the tool and trying to force it to be used because they think it's cool. But yeah, it should definitely,
which is fun. You have to, right? You have to break it.
Yeah.
You have to break it before, you know, you can you know like how to take care of it and you know, keep it running, and you know, like a, you know, like a good car.
Are you guys starting to use virtual production techniques more these days?
Absolutely. We have an offshoot called iLine, which is now powered by Netflix, as well as Scanline. And iLine has been working, you know, that I would say they're our technical branch that developed from Scanline. And they're really pushing forward in, you know, in every way possible to figure out like how to, again, best serve the story, how to, you know, create films in a way where you can spend more time working things out and, you know, really putting forth the energy in the final product, you know, rather than, you know, there's always this, push to figure it out later. And I think, you know, virtual production kind of forces you, because especially if you have environments, you have to pre-build that, you have to make decisions. And I think that's great, you know, making decisions and, you know, but you have to have the time. You know, there's nothing worse than going, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to do it this way, but we need this environment. And it comes up short, and then you're like, you know, only works now for this type of shot. it doesn't quite work out for this type of shot. So you end up, doing traditional visual effects. So it's really just, just getting everybody on board and figuring out how to use the tool in the best way.
Yeah, and it spans a lot of different things as well, from the previs, live previs version of it, all the way through to in-camera visual effects.
Yeah.
Not really one thing. I know people always call it virtual production, like it's one thing, but it isn't really.
No, and I think it's if you know you're going in to use it as a previs tool, which is great, then you go in knowing that and to help kind of figure things out. When our industry kind of shut down a bit, at the beginning of COVID, iLine, took the reins in, diving into virtual production and kind of figuring out for themselves, what does it take? So they built the LED wall and, all the sensors and doing mocap and we were doing demos, at least 2-3 times a week with filmmakers and just kind of learning from those demos and creating environments and, but also having discussions with filmmakers and going, this is kind of the new way of how we can make movies, and showed them a lot of cool little gadgets. And, I think there were some that were like, I can really catch on to this. Like one of the coolest things I thought was not even the huge LED wall, but we had like a 8x12 rectangular LED wall where you can put up still frames or you can put up videos from YouTube, excuse me, and just like having a conversation on a train, for example. You can have two people sitting next to each other with the background moving, and a director could sit there with their iPhone or whatever, film it, and kind of use it as a tool to kind of figure out like what that scene is going to be or how they can, what the lines need to be, or and there's a million things. And I thought the low res version of virtual production to me was really exciting because it allows you to do something that you would do on a grander scale but in a little bit of a low-tech way.
Yeah, you get to kind of, sorry, my camera's died for a second, it'll be back. I like it.
No worries.
I have to buy a fan to blow onto the camera to stop it overheating. it allows you to practice, essentially, is what you're saying. It allows you to be able to try things out before you get to that expensive phase where you're spending lots of money on visual effects. And yeah, there's lots of benefits to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, what I've learned is being on the production side of visual effects, being a overall supervisor, is that everything has a price. There's a line item, or there's money that needs to be attached to everything, and so you have to be really smart and make sure that your money goes a long way. I get that, but it's a whole new world.
So, I think my camera should be good again. Here we go. Okay. Nothing like a live show with a couple of technical things going wrong.
Just so you don't feel bad.
It's all right. I'm back. Thank you. I wanted to ask you a little bit about when you got into the industry, things, and me too, 15, 16 years ago, was usually you got in through Roto and prep, and some of those things have been outsourced quite a while ago. What's it like for somebody new to the visual effects industry these days? What's a typical, if there is one, typical kind of path in at this point?
Well, I think still roto. Like if you want to be a compositor, for example, roto is so important. If you think as a compositor that you'll just wait for the roto, or you can't do something until your roto is done, I don't know how good of a compositor you're gonna be. At the end of the day, I'm kind of old school in that where, I like to get in there and maybe my roto is not gonna be great, but I'm gonna get stuff done, look at it, get it shown, get it's about iterations. And if there is somebody doing a roto and I have to wait, so be it, for that final kind of look. But you got to get in there, you got to grind and get those answers, and sooner the better, or else last thing you want to do is you have you're down the end of the line and you want to final this shot, and if you wish you had 10 iterations either to show the director or to figure something out yourself. I think that's really kind of so important, is to, I think people always ask me, like, how did I become a visual effects supervisor? And I think a lot of it was, just trusting in myself and my instincts. So you would get a task, and the one thing I learned very quickly is do the task. Like if a supervisor says, do this, and they want this, this, and this, you do that, and you try, obviously, do your best. And then if you have any ideas, make sure that you do that, kind of figure that out on your own time a little bit. And then when you think you have something that, like, you told me to do this, and you show them, and you're like, well, last night I stayed a little hour or two, and I kind of came up with this. And those are the moments where, you kind of look into it and you go, like, how would I do it? How would I make it better? What are my ideas? And then, have the confidence to kind of put forth those ideas, or, you learn to get thick skin as well, because, an artist, you're not sitting there in front of your easel and just making your art. You're making art for many people down the line. So you have to have thick skin and know how to take constructive criticism and comments, and and when you disagree with them, how do you build yourself back up and get back into the ring and start fighting? And some of those are like, just, instead of just thinking it could be better, try to make it better, obviously, but without, disrupting up the process and time of when things need to be done. Obviously, those types of things, unless you're, a concept artist where they basically say, figure it out and, come up with something, you still need to do what your supervisors are asking of you first. But I think that's one of the things that kind of pushes you forward, is just trusting in yourself. And we all want to see good movies. We all want to, have fun doing it. And I think that's a good start.
Yeah, some great advice there, and also leaning into the kind of soft skills side of it, where you really like, especially if you want to go into leadership and become a CG or comp soup, and or then visual effects soup, you really have to learn the leadership side of things as well, about how to encourage your team. What are some of the things that help you in wanting to progress into leadership roles?
Well, I think, it really starts with wanting to, you learn to be a leader. Like, not, you a lot of people have the ability to do certain things. I know a lot of technically and artistic artists who do amazing shot work, but when it comes to leading, there's a certain skill set other than artistic that you need to kind of have. And it, like I said, it took me a while. I wanted to be a leader. I had to learn hard. you know, how to treat people. And basically what I've come out of it is, you know, treat people the way you would want to be treated. And that will go a super long way. and excuse me, I might have to jump out and grab a water.
Sure. Yep.
But I think that's kind of the key role. I made a lot of mistakes, you know, when I was younger. And, you know, you have to be able to learn from those and hopefully, you know, come out stronger because of it. But once you kind of get an understanding of like what it means to be part of a team and how exciting when even what I used to tell my teams were, we don't have control over the final product. Like there is studios, directors, producers, actors, actresses, you know, whatever. There's going to be a lot of people kind of throwing their two cents in. But what we do have control is what we're putting out there. Like we have control over our sequences, our shots, you know, to do the best job we possibly can. And at the end of the day, you know, how it fits into the whole, I don't know. You know, hopefully good. But we can be proud. Like I've never been prouder. Just, you know, we would do our monthlies where at the end of a show, we'd string all our visual effects shots together and just show them, you know, one after the other, not in context of the movie or anything like that. And it was just beautiful. And we're like so proud of each other for doing this great work. Now, how it fits in and how it's edited and how it all comes together and the music and all that, you know, again, you just hope everybody's doing their job. But I said, you know, that's our goal. You know, if we can make our monthly's final reel look amazing, then we're probably doing a good job.
Yeah. Absolutely. If you do want to go grab a glass of
water, let me do that, please. Very welcome to.
I can do a little commercial break in the middle, which I haven't done before, but we wanted to just talk about a couple of things that we're doing at CG Pro in the middle. We have a couple of courses coming up where we have game design is on our next class. We're doing game design in Unreal Engine. That is coming up at the beginning of October. We're seeing definitely some people trending towards Unreal Engine. That class is starting to fill up. If you're very welcome to jump into that one. We also have our next world building course in Unreal Engine, which is we're doing with Narwhal, formerly Happy Mushroom, who did all the worlds in the Mandalorian and Book of Boba Fett. We're also always doing Unreal Engine for filmmakers, and that runs every 2 months. So some of the courses that we're running are upcoming. And we'll be at Unreal Fest next week. If you want to catch up, if you're coming to Unreal Fest, please do join us at our meetup, which we're going to post some information about. We're going to do a meetup at the event. I'd love to catch up with you there. I'm very looking forward to that event in New Orleans next week. All right, commercial break done, inserted, off the cuff. Here we go. We're back.
Thank you very much for that well-needed drink.
I totally get it. Yeah, I remember to put that in my notes to recommend that guests grab a glass of water.
I thought about it, but it was just one of those things. We started talking, you know, before the show, and it was really fun. So I thought I'd make it. It's like we call it garage door syndrome in our house. Like, you know, you go out for the day, and then it's not until you're like on your way home, and you're like, how fast can we get home? You know, we need to get home real quick because I need to use the washroom.
Right. And it gets more intense the closer you get.
Anyway.
So, we're talking a little bit about today's version of breaking into the industry and how it's evolved. It sounds like in the comp side, not so different maybe, and still learning those kind of entry. Roto skills.
Absolutely. And, you know, and from the CG side, I think it's like to your point, generalist, you know, just I think there's a lot of schools, there's a lot more education I think, from when I was, you know, and a lot of the friends that I worked with getting into the business back in the day, there's a lot more learning out there, and there's a lot more softwares you can download. And so I think having an understanding of all those different principles in CG, lighting, obviously modeling, having a little, you know, understanding what animation is doesn't mean you need to be a great animator. I think timing is, regardless, you know, either it's 2D or 3D, just having a sense of timing is really important. And, you know, I would say to your point, you know, in the world we live in now, softwares like Unreal, like, which has a lot of all those parameters inside. And I think that, you know, let's be honest, you know, virtual production isn't perfect right now, but I think it's going there, you know, and there it's going there in a big way. And, you know, Unreal started as a game, mostly as for games, and now it's moving into, you know, television and film. Like, who knows where else it's going to lead, you know, after. So there's, for those types of game engine softwares and procedures, I think you can't go wrong learning that type of stuff. I want to learn it. I want to be a world builder. I have ideas. I'm not a visual effects supervisor. That's my day job. you know, I have projects. I have, you know, I have wonderful dreams of wonderful places and wonderful things. So, yeah, I mean, it's really about the tools, but definitely that would be something I would suggest right off the bat.
Learning the fundamentals and understanding what's in comp, what a pixel's made of in CG, what are 3D things made of. They're still made of the same things they were when 3D was invented, and yeah, understanding how that works is,
and more importantly, you know, taking photography classes,
yeah,
you know, learning light and dark, like, that's, to be honest, that's kind of like, I've never taking those classes, but I have a habit of kind of just gazing out of windows. You know, my wife, you know, is always like,
hey, Jimmy,
snap out of it. But I like to look, like, just like right now, the trees are moving, the trees, the leaves are getting hit by light, and, you know, just kind of looking out into the world and just seeing how things are affected. And, you know, when the wind blows or when it doesn't blow, or, you know, when there's humidity, or, you know, the world changes constantly. And that's what I think, you know, at the end of the day, is kind of having a sense of those changes, as minute as they are, or, you know, like in Day After Tomorrow, how extreme.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's kind of been my calling card. You know, I've kind of a world destructor. Like, I don't know how many cities that I've had part in destruction on the big screen, and planets and that sort of thing. So yeah.
We should do a course called that. We do a world building in Unreal Engine course. We should do a world destroying
in Unreal. Oh yeah, there's definitely a good feeling when, you know, blowing something up or tearing something down.
Very, very satisfying.
Very satisfying. Yeah, it takes a while. You know, that's right. That's what I love. Those types of effects for me they're super hard, because there's obviously physical attributes that you want to maintain, and you know, the simulations, the software gets better and better, where you're able to plug in parameters and get closer to something. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, at Scanline, we were fortunate enough to have a water software called Flowline, and the ability to render, you know, over multiple machines. And no matter how close we got to realism, It was always then the director or like wanted it to have a quality, you know, another quality. And so a lot of times, you know, you go, you show them something that's physically correct and it doesn't quite do it for them. You know, they want something bigger, better. And then you start, that's where the art direction comes in. And that's where, you know, it starts breaking a little. But again, it, you, at the end of the day, you look at how it plays in the cut and how it plays in the story. And it, it is that wow moment that you need, you know, for those, you know, whatever frames that is. So, but I always like to start, you know, physically based and, you know, do my homework.
Right. Yeah. Figure out what an early mentor said, learn the rules before you break them.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The, speaking of change and evolving, there's lots of change and evolution going on in our industry at the moment. Love to hear your thoughts on how what we're going through right now. You know, we're going through this kind of all these changes we're experiencing, striking. I know that yesterday it seems like maybe the, at least the writer side that's kind of coming back a little bit. How's that been affecting you guys, and what are your thoughts on it?
Well, my thoughts are, yes,
yeah,
we can get back to work.
Yep.
The rock is only halfway up the hill. I think we all need to get behind the people pushing that rock and get it, you know, get it up the hill so we can get back to work. And, you know, so that's number one, you know, is getting everybody back to work and doing something that we love and, you know, taking care of our families and, you know, getting, feeling whole again. But, you know, which is a good question in that, you know, we've been seeing strikes from, you know, the writers and the actors, and they're unionized, and, you know, our visual effects community doesn't quite have that support.
We don't have that luxury. Yeah.
No, but, you know, I don't want to belabor it, you know, this industry has grown in tenfold since I started, and it's still growing, and there the amount of artists and people that work on films, when you look at the credits, it way outnumbers, you know, the whole entity of who is making the film on a lot of projects, and yet we have the least, the quietest voice. And I don't know if there's much we can do in my lifetime in visual effects, and I'll try the most I can do. But I think there's, you know, a new generation of visual effects artists or people who want to be in this industry. That's really who I think we need to look out for. You know, while I have the experience of where we started and where, you know, we've kind of all been through the ringer. I've been in this industry since 1986, and I've been an artist since, you know, 1990, 1992. And kind of, I've been through strikes. I've been through a lot. And what it really comes down to is, you know, visual effects, we are a passionate lot. You know, we're a motley crew of very passionate people who, again, you know, we have this thing called technology that constantly gets thrown in front of us. And, you know, just when we think, you know, it's getting boring, you know, something new, you know, there's a faster machine or the software can do something different, or, you know, or there's a new, like, vision of what we can do. And it's just that constant clawing at trying to do something really amazing. And I think that kind of has put visual effects artists kind of kept them down in a way, because you have the big, you know, you have the adults, the studios, who are kind of dictating how much sandbox we get to play in, but then are kind of, you know, once we're like, okay, I had my 8 hours of fun in the sandbox, and then they're like, no, you have to spend another 8 hours. And you're like, oh no, it's time to go take a shower and and wash the sand off. And so I at the end of the day, I think we need to look out for the next generation. They need to look out for themselves. I think the biggest thing is kind of like what the unions are doing is solidarity. And I think that's a world, like, nothing's going to get done if you only have LA visual effects artists unionized. You know, you need everybody, all the visual effects in every country. It needs to be a global unionization. Everybody needs to be on the same page, knowing that this visual effects thing is not going away. It's only going to keep going. And we're really smart people. Like, I work with rocket scientists. I work with and yet we can't figure out how to put some things in out there where we can be taken care of, and, you know, not be put in positions where you know, some people can take care of themselves, you know, where they can make decisions. And sometimes family kind of pushes us into making those decisions. And then there's some who just don't have that luxury of, and get kind of taken in with the ebb and tide of, ebb and flow of the tide. And, you know, you can drown, you know, it's a really hard discussion, but something needs to be done. We need to, like, it's not going to get done today, but if we said in 5 years, if we just all put our heads together and say, in 5 years, can we come up with some sort of groundbreaking building blocks of how we can at least initiate some, you know what I mean? It's, that is a way to start, is to actually start, but know that it's not going to be done next month. You know, and maybe it takes 10 years, maybe it takes 20 years, but I think we as a community need to really acknowledge that we're just going to be floating out there unless, you know, we have an anchor. And that anchor is taking care of our future generations. If it's our family or our visual effects community.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I mean, really, we were talking earlier about the sleeping under your desk. And we said, I always tried to sleep in the flame suite because they had the most comfortable place.
Absolutely.
To sleep. But yeah, if you get a little older and you want to not have to do that as much. The passion is definitely what drove me into the industry as well, and wanting to make it sustainable is what you're describing.
Absolutely.
For us to be able to keep doing it because we love doing it.
Yeah. I think we have if we took 10% of all the smart people who are, you know, pushing forward all the technology in our industry. And, you know, to be honest, when COVID hit, it was visual effects and that had the technology to basically lockstep right in. You know, we didn't skip a beat. We were able to
like expand line.
Yeah, in 1 week, basically get everybody working at home. and not just on a Zoom, you know, where a lot of companies, you know, they can keep working because all they really need to do is talk to people. Whereas we, you know, are locked into a pipeline and we're able to use the software and we're able to render. And, we were able to do that, like it was nothing. And which was a great thing, I think. I know I miss working with people and being in the same room with people. This is great. We kind of get our points across and, but there's something about being in the room and you can tell, you know, if people are having a good day or a bad day, you know, there's just this osmosis that you get. Whereas, if you're on a Zoom call, you can just, do that. And, if you're having a bad day, or, you had a rough night, or whatever the case may be, I like to be a part of that. I like, if somebody's having a rough night, on the phone, you can't tell. And then you're just barking orders and you're just rah, rah, rah. We got to do this. We got to do that. And, you don't really learn, a lot from not being in the same room with people. And then, going back to your question about new artists, I think it sucks for them because you're learning all this stuff online, you're learning software. But for me, it was my peers. It was sitting in a room, like in that flame. We had flame cubicles. We didn't have the fancy flame room at the Digital Domain. We had flame cubicles. But we were able to raise our head and go, hey, come over here, check this out. And you play it and you show it to somebody and they would, give you their, constructive criticism, and you would show it to a couple other people. And you knew, if it can't get past these guys or girls, how's it going to get past my supervisor? And it made you think, and it made, and you learn from that. And I think that's one of the things I really feel we need to get back to somehow, is getting the younger generation in the same room with people so that they can learn and not just be a talking head, or getting your information from a chat room, or which is great, everything helps. But I have to tell you, man, there's something about a bonding and being working with people and
in that tension, I think, is where creativity is born a lot of the time, is that place where you do disagree, but you have to live with it. You have to make it work. Like if you don't get on with your neighbor where you live, you can sit there warring for years, or you can, if you're that close together, then you have to kind of figure it out. And in that can be born, that's where we learn about stuff. I agree. I wonder whether there's a better version of the online, and I'm sure there is, but being able to be in the same space. Are you guys all work from home? Do you have some kind of a hybrid version?
Yeah, there's a hybrid version, which I believe they try to do as much as possible. When we have, obviously when we have client reviews, we try to get the client to the facility to see stuff big whenever possible. Unfortunately, that has become harder and harder because as a client, they're already, when you go out to shoot, either you're on multiple locations, or when you finally get back after shooting, it's not like you want to be driving around town all the time. So the review process, unfortunately, from the client, and I used to love just being with the client, because again, you're face to face, you're talking through stuff, you're working things out, you're bringing them, we used to have desk walkthroughs, and you can take an hour and you go to every artist and you go, show me what you're working on, and you go over their list, and there, you have a little conversation, you tell a story, you kind of find a place where you feel comfortable, and that's not happening. And the same thing with the client, or getting a director in. I mean, back in the day, we used to have directors come to our screening room, and we would show them the work, and they would give us so much inspiration, because they were really excited, because they're seeing stuff come off from the script page, and now be on the screen, which they couldn't shoot in the past. So those days, I wish more directors and productions took more time to really spend time with the artists, and because there's something, it's inspirational when you're with somebody who is just as passionate. you know, it goes a long way. I mean, I've worked on some pretty bad movies with some really fun directors, and they made the experience worth it because they are just as excited. They just get you pumped up. And I think that's what, you know, what a good director is. They get you pumped up and, you know, and not just, you know, what have you done for me lately? Like, you know, they're in it, you know?
Yeah, that energy is like if you're in a band, you don't want to play in a band to an empty room. You want your audience there giving you some feedback and giving you, that's what helps you perform.
As long as there's one person rocking out, I'm good.
Yeah. I mean, you just need a video playing of somebody doing that on your third monitor.
I've been there. I used to roadie for my band, for friends' bands back in the day, and I've been to a couple at the Whiskey or something like that where I'm the only one.
I've played some of those shows too. I think the only audience is like your mom or someone in the crew.
Very important though. Your mom's very important.
Absolutely. Thanks, mom. I owe her a lot. Is there anything that you're, you know, technology wise, anything that you're excited to be seeing emerging these days?
I'm a big fan of reality twinning, either it be environments, people, crowds. I want to figure out the crowd, you know, that's always, at least in my experience, you know, we started back in the day with, forget the software, but, you know, you were able to build a brain and the crowd.
Massive, maybe?
Massive, yes. Sorry. Which was amazing. And, you know, which is, you know, building a brain, it's a little different than machine learning, I think, because you set the parameters and it doesn't necessarily get better unless you tell it to get better. You know what I mean? Whereas, you know, now you have machine learning and you just expect it to figure it out for you. And, you know, and then, you know, you get something and you hopefully, it, you know, it works out well. But I'm all about the brain building and, you know, making sure that, you know, what's in here gets in there and not letting it just go off on its own.
There's a lot of proceduralism bleeding into a lot of the tools. Like Houdini's been paving the way, I think, for everybody in that respect.
Yeah.
But now we're seeing it in Unreal and Blender and some.
Well, it's just those tasks, you know, instances. Like when I worked on San Andreas, we, you know, had a flood San Francisco with a big tsunami, and we, you know, a city of that size, you know, on the water after it was just there, you had tons of garbage, and, you know, we had to take, how do you take, you know, 100 or 200 pieces that you build and then make it look like millions? And, you know, you have procedural, so you alter them and then instance them so you can take that 200 and make 10,000 of them, you know. So that is the beauty of, you know, where I think things go, where you can quickly populate and have it look great and real and, you know, and move the way you want it to move.
And tools wise, are we seeing any evolutions? I think we talked about Unreal Engine starting to get used a lot more, especially in virtual production. Blender is progressed a hell of a lot. Are you starting to see that being used by artists?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's definitely the way things go. Also reality capture and those types of softwares, using photogrammetry and, you know, using that to build environments. One of the, I don't know, we're short for time, but one of my last projects, The Gray Man, we were able to work with a company called Mosaic 51 in Prague, because that's where we were shooting, and they had a 360-degree camera, and we basically gave them specs of, like, more than what their 360 camera was able to do, but essentially they built a rig on a car, and we were able to tell them, you know, to go shoot before the sun came up, you know, just as it was to get flat environment, and they would drive around and capture thousands and thousands of images, then take those images and use them to build the geometry. And so now you have a flat image on geometry, and now, you know, which are the building blocks of, you know, creating an environment. You know, we still went out and LiDAR'd everything, so we had high-res geometry, but we just switched that geo out with the photography. And then when we needed our team to build it in the look development, you know, modeling cleaned everything up, and then we basically had that street or that environment, and now we had to go in and make it high-res in those areas that we needed to be high res, or, you know, or build out a building where we knew there was going to be destruction or what have you. But that was the most exciting, you know, doing stuff like that, where we were quickly able to, you know, create an environment. Whereas in the past you would LiDAR something, and then you would take textures and photography and basically piece by piece, you know, kludge it together to make it kind of work. And, but, you know, now you have almost at your fingertips the base that you can build from, and you know exactly what it looks like, and it's very helpful. So
that's cool. Yes, seeing the work that Cesium and Google Tiles have done to kind of bring the whole world into stream into your Unreal Viewport or Blender or wherever to be able to kind of start off from that point compared to what you used to have to do. Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
No, there's some, you know, I can go on and on. I love visual effects and trying to figure out how to do it in a way where the artist, you know, just has more reference, or, you know, starting on a higher level. There's so much work that goes into what we do that nobody sees. And so our job as supervisors is to kind of figure out how to, okay, we were doing it this way, now let's bring it up a level, and, you know, let's jump at a higher point of the production pipeline instead of starting from scratch every time.
And there's so many things that people have made now as well, like the libraries that I remember when you used to have to make everything from scratch, as you say, every single polygon or pixel is built from scratch. But now there's, think of, I need an oil rig or something. It's like 50 oil rigs on TurboSquid that look great.
Yeah. You know,
they're just there. Like, yeah, it's pretty cool.
I mean, I just was on a movie you know, usually we would LiDAR every set, but, you know, I have a iPad, and I would, on sets where they were just, you know, talking heads, I'd go and, you know, at least we had something for tracking, you know, in case we needed to do something. And it's just, it's amazing. I couldn't tell you, like, it's so cool.
Yeah. Oh, I'm with you. I'm excited about it too. Is there anything, as we wrap, is there anything that you'd like to share with the audience? Anywhere they can follow you? Anything that
I don't know. I'm around. I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook. I really don't have any real social media presence, but I know a lot of people though. I'm sure, like, if you work at a facility, there's at least one person in there that might know me. And I'm kind of an open door. Feel free, you know, even if you haven't been in this business, I get a lot of messages on LinkedIn from people who are looking to get into the industry, or just have questions, or just want to show me stuff. Which is really cool. I'm really big about mentoring and, you know, trying to help people, you know, at least show them the pathways, you know, where the doors are. You know, I wish I can open the doors for everybody. It doesn't happen that way. A lot of times it's yourself. You need to, you know, they say, you know, you got to put yourself in the best position. You know, timing is everything. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's like practice. You know, you go, if you want to make it, you got to keep going. You got to keep knocking on those doors until one of those doors open. If you really want to do it, there's no magic pill. You know, you have to, you know, if you don't have a great reel, then you need to figure out another way. Like, you know, if they need somebody to answer phones, you know, knowing that, you know, all you need is just a little exposure, you know, all you need is just to be in your foot in the door. I think that goes a long way because people, you know, if you want to do something, you can do it. Nobody should tell you no. But nobody's going to, you know, make it easy for you either. I'll try the most I can, but, you know, I think listening and just being aware of your environment and knowing what you're getting into, like we were talking before, like, you know, this industry, like a lot of industries, has its ups and its downs, and you should be listening to all of those things.
It's great advice. Yeah, it really is. I agree. But it is up to the person, to the individual. You have to work hard to do something at a world-class level. You have to. There's no way. It shouldn't be easy. You should have to work for it a bit. And that's, I think, where knowing that you it's a worthy goal for you, it comes in as the first step, like knowing that you really want it. And then knowing people, having mentors, growing some skills, putting those together into something you show people, and just persistence, as you said, that's a fantastic one. I mean, the number of rejections I had just to ILM before they actually let me in through those doors, it was right. I think 6 or 7.
Yeah, no, you got to keep pushing, and it's worth it, because at the end of the day, like I said, you know, sometimes you work on these great projects, sometimes they're not so great, but the people. Yeah. Okay, the people, all my best friends, my community of friends are mostly through the visual effects business. I've worked with them for many years. They're, you know, my heart and soul, you know, and I look forward to working with them whenever I can, and working with new people and having, you know, that moment where that aha, where, you know, we're like-minded. You know, it's work, but you get a lot out of it if you know where to look and you know what's important to you as an individual. I think that's super important, like what's important to you and what you want to get out of it, because there's so much on the other side of, you know, what other people want to get out of you. Right. And so you got to have that balance.
I think it's great advice as well, where you shared being taking agency in your own boundaries, or a better way of saying, just stand up for yourself. As well as it's a balance there, has been for me. And in the beginning, you're just trying to get anybody to notice you or open the door.
Need some water?
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate it. You're at the beginning, you're trying to just, you're knocking at doors, no one's opening them, but you're trying to get people to notice you, and then you get to the point where someone gives you a chance and you give it everything, but you still have to work on your own boundaries and take care of yourself, look after yourself. It's important.
Yeah, but you know, also you know, just from a work, you know, ethic too, you know, I've always scared myself into, you're only as good as your last comp, you know, back in the day when I was a comper, you know, not to get too above, you know, what you do. Because what I found, I've worked with a lot of people and also myself, you know, life throws you a lot of curveballs. And like, I've worked on shows where I'm like, bam, 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 knocking stuff down and, you know, figuring stuff out and, you know, hero, rock star, blah, blah, blah. You know, and then something happens in your family, or, you know, and it kind of knocks you down a little bit. And now you're on a movie and you just can't quite get it. You know, you're just a little slower. You're not thinking clearly. And that's just life. And, you know, that goes along with, you know, everybody. You have to kind of be able to look at your peers and the people around you and know that and be good with that, because, you know, life is there for everyone. Like, you know, we all get hit with those real life situations, and it's kind of like, my favorite is from I think it was one of the Rocky movies, where he was yelling at his son, not yelling, but he was trying to tell his son, because his son was saying that all the bad things in his life came because he was, you know, the son of Rocky Balboa. And he's like, you know, life is about getting knocked down and it's getting back up. And I just love that little speech, but it's true. It's like, you can point the finger all you want, you know, of why things might, you know, not go your way, or, but at the end of the day, it's like having those things happen and, you know, figuring out how to keep moving forward and try to learn from it and grow.
Yeah, no, that's great. Great advice. Because you're right. Those things will happen. They do happen. I remember lots of times I've been like the king for a day, and then the next day you're the opposite of that somehow. And yeah. It happens, and it's okay. And
it happens to all of us. And that's why, I mean, you really need to kind of know your, you know, know yourself and know that, you know, nobody's perfect.
I think a lot of this stuff applies, you know, to any industry too. Like you quoted the Rocky movie. I love that quote as well. I love that one. It's just, what it implies, which is that you don't expect to have just be king for the day every day. It's not going to be that way. You're going to have times where you just feel like giving up, or you feel like you're no good, or there's that creeps into everybody's.
All the time, all the time. Even, you know, I'm not immune to that either, you know. But what I've found is, like, I love taking I like creating time so I can take a little walk and just kind of mull it over, you know, and then give myself time to talk myself out of it, you know, and just start pumping myself up, you know. And, you know, a lot of time it's music, and music gets me through a lot.
Yeah, that's great advice too. I think that taking a break, stepping away from things, is always a great way of solving problems too. Walk away from it and something loosens up and you figure it out, or you just getting your body moving, and that's often the way I figure things out. Like my last boss would say, okay, I need to like book a hike to figure that one out.
Exactly, you know. And then everybody's different, right? So you just need to find that outlet to give you the space. That's all.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for coming in today. I really appreciate you. It's been tremendous fun, great conversation. Oh, I appreciate your time. Thanks for sharing all your wisdom, at least some of it anyway. I know there's more.
That's all I got. Unless you got a quarter, you can put it in the, you know, maybe something else will pop out. But
I'd love to have you back sometime. Maybe you could come and chat to the school at some point. But it's been a
real anytime pleasure. Anytime, let me know.
Amazing. Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you again, and thanks also to our audience. Thanks for showing up today, and I appreciate you all being here. Look forward to seeing you again in another couple of weeks for episode 58. And we've been CG Pro. This is the CG Pro podcast. Follow us at becomecgpro.com. If you're at Unreal Fest next week, we'll be there live in real life, not just over Zoom. So it would be great to meet you. But thanks, everybody. Have a great day, and we'll see you.
Bye. Thank you. Care.